let's pick up tonight. I'd like to go through the book of Nahum. And the reason I want to go through Nahum tonight is because last week we went through the book of Jonah. And Nahum and Jonah have this in common in terms of their prophesying against the city of Nineveh. Now, Nineveh, as you remember from last week, was the capital of Assyria. And at the time, Assyria was obviously a very, very powerful nation. They were the world-dominant force at the time that Jonah was alive. And they had a notorious reputation for being such a very cruel and wicked and idolatrous nation that was steeped in all kinds of witchcraft and sorcery. And they were noted for their cruelty. I mean, they would go forth and conquer people and conquer nations and conquer lands, and very often they would they'd end up impaling their enemies on poles or decapitating them and stacking up their heads, in big, huge mounds in front of city gates. That they would skin people alive. They would do some of the most gross, inhumane, dehumanizing things to other people. The people they would conquer, they would enslave them. Their cruelty knew no bounds. And that's why God told Jonah, go, I want you to go prophesy against this city. And he said, 40 days, I'm going to destroy you. But as we read last week, Jonah's message really hit home with these people. They knew how wicked they were, and they knew that this was a prophet of God. And they also had, I think, enough, let's say, tradition or understanding that God means what he says and says what he means. For example, when he overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, that's the word that is used there. I mean, fire rained down from heaven, and the smoke of the fire went up like a great furnace. So I guess these people figured that's what's going to happen to us. We're just going to be vaporized here. And they repented. But now, Nahum comes upon the scene about 100 to 150 years later. And he prophesies against this same city because they have fallen right back into their old ways. They have fallen right back into their wickedness and their vileness and their sorceries and their cruelty and their mercy. And so God says, you're finished, you're done, you're through, it's over. And so what happened to the city of Nineveh was that around 614 B.C., the Babylonians and the Medes besieged the city. And after a two-year siege, I mean, they just overran them, and they just virtually killed every man, woman, and child. I mean, they just completely devastated that city of Nineveh. And God just basically said he was going to dig their grave. And as a matter of fact, he dug their grave so deep that for centuries, tens of centuries, people could not find the ruins of Nineveh. As a matter of fact, some of the critics of the Bible thought that Nineveh never even existed. But I think it was the latter part of the 19th century, they discovered, a guy named by the name of Laird discovered the ruins of Nineveh, and they unearthed it, and they have found that it was a city that was it was massive. I mean, some of the statistics that I read, it says the walls of Nineveh stood over 100 feet high and 50 feet thick. And on her walls were towers rising 200 feet above the ground, and in her walls were 15 massive gates. Surrounding the city was a moat of 150 feet wide. And the city itself was like 30 miles long and about 10 miles wide, but it's believed that these were surrounding villages or cities within. It's like you have Sacramento City, but also all these different counties around. So it was a pretty massive city. It also had a library that contained over 100,000 different books, and they were able to unearth 30,000 of them. And so we have the historical account of the city of Nineveh. I mean, it's been substantiated through archaeology. So, you know, once again, it's kind of like put an end to many of the critics who scoffed at the idea that the city of Nineveh even existed. All right, but I wanted to give you that background before we get into this, because when we read this book of Nahum, it deals specifically with its destruction. And I think that, again, we see how the Apostle Paul tells us in the New Testament that all of Scripture is given to us for our instruction, for our understanding, for our edification, for our reproof, for our example. And I think there can be a lot that can be gleaned from reading what happened to the city of Nineveh, because I believe this is going to happen to every nation on earth that turns away from God, that forgets God, that turns to idols, And I think there's a pretty constructive lesson for the United States in what is written here. Anyway, beginning with verse 1, it says, the oracle of Nineveh. And the oracle, basically, it means burden, the burden of Nineveh. I think some Bibles say that. In other words, this is going to be a weighty, heavy message. All right? The oracle of Nineveh. The book of the vision of Nahum, the Eschoshite. Nobody knows where this is located, but I think that in the New Testament, the city of Capernaum is also known as, it means literally the city of Nahum. So Nahum may have been from Capernaum. Anyway, he says in verse 2, a jealous and avenging God is the Lord. A Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserves wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power, and the Lord will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. And whirlwind and storm is his way, and clouds are the dust beneath his feet. He rebukes the sea, and it makes it dry. He dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither, and the blossoms of the Lebanon wither. Mountains quake because of him, and the hills dissolve. Indeed, the earth is upheaved by his presence, and the world and all its inhabitants, all the inhabitants in it. Who can stand before his indignation? Who can endure the burning of his anger? His wrath is poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken up by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in a day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him, but with an overflowing flood he will make a complete end of its sight, and he will pursue his enemies into darkness. Now, before we go any further, this is a prophecy, an oracle, a burden, a message that is directed against Nineveh. It's prophesying is total and utter destruction. But if you read the first few verses of this, it doesn't specifically mention Nineveh here. It's talking about more or less how God had manifests his power and his might in nature before it even begins to get into the destruction of Nineveh. And I think it's very instructive, because what God is basically saying here is, look what happens as far as everything that happens in nature. I mean, during the 90s, that was known as the decade of disaster, because of all of the natural disasters and the calamities that hit our planet in that 10-year period of time. And you look at it, costs billions and billions and billions, untold billions of dollars worth of property damage, all the tornadoes and the floods and the earthquakes and the forest fires and on and on and on and on. Well, it's basically saying, look, God is behind all of that. He orchestrates all of this, what's happening in nature. I mean, look at the things that he's saying here. We'll just look back to verse 2. He's a jealous and avenging God. He's a vengeful and a wrathful God. He reserves wrath for his enemies. I think that really needs to be stressed home today. I really do, because people have lost sight of this. We've become, unfortunately, not only a nation and a society, but even the church itself seems to just have this same drumbeat. Now, not all churches, but the majority of churches today have lost sight of this. Instead, you go in there to on Sunday to hear a sermon, and it's basically the sermon amounts to nothing more than, hey, look, I'm okay and you're okay, and God is love and God is merciful. And they project God as being some senile, benevolent old granddaddy who just wants to pat us on the head and just say, hey, you just have a good time and enjoy yourself. It doesn't matter what you think and what you believe and how you act, you know, because everybody's going to get to heaven. I mean, this is the message that comes out. If it doesn't come out verbally, then it comes out with the whole attitude that's presented about God. But here, if you read this, it says the Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries. He reserves wrath for his enemies. He is slow to anger and great in power. Okay, he's slow to anger. But man, when he rises up to move in anger, look out. As a matter of fact, I think it's in Psalms where Moses says, arise, O Lord, and scatter your enemies. I mean, it's almost as though God is sitting on his throne, and people for centuries, and even people in this country, I mean, for the past 3-4 decades, I mean, God has, is being insulted, he's being blasphemed day and night by so many of our cultural elite and people in general. And he's been just taking this. But there'll come a day when he will stand up in anger. Oh, man, and the people will run, you know, like rats running after the turn a light on, and they would be running for cover. I don't say that facetiously. I'm just saying that simply because God is long-suffering and he's patient, man, don't misread him, because he's only going to take so much. When a cup of iniquity reaches that point of overflowing, then he will arise. And he says here, but he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. But then it goes on to talk about in whirlwind and storm and in clouds and in dust and in rivers and in droughts and all these other natural disasters. He's behind it all. So it kind of sets the stage to say, this is the God who's behind all of nature. Now, this same God is the same God that's behind all of the military collapses or disasters or defeats or, you know, whatever else happens, all the destruction of war, because war is a punishment from Almighty God. There's no two ways about it. Just what happened on the September 11th when, the Twin Towers went down, God permitted that. He allowed that. He orchestrated that in this sense. He was trying to get our attention. One of the most unfortunate things that happened after September 11th was somebody like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robinson basically came out and said, well, this happened to us because of the homosexual crowd and because of the ACLU and because of abortions. Well, he missed it. He missed the point. Because I can guarantee you these elements, even though they are so wicked and they are tearing our country apart morally, they would not have gained the inroads that they have today if it hadn't been for the whole nation collectively, and especially the church in general, who, if they were really diligent in their commitment to God, these people wouldn't have such a strong foothold in this nation, and they wouldn't cause so much wickedness. Anyway, he says verse 7, it says, the Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him. So in other words, regardless of what calamity hits, if you are right with God when calamity hits, if you are right with God and you're in the midst of an earthquake or a natural disaster or even in the midst of a war or something, if you have this peace with God, sure, but it's just going to be a natural reaction that you're probably going to be scared. You're probably going to be, maybe even terrified. You're going to have a natural anxiety or fear. But if you have a peace with God, you know, okay, if this is my time, I'm ready to go. And nothing can give a person, you know, such a sense of well-being as that. Because, let's say, if God is not your stronghold and you have put all your trust in money or fame or popularity or material things, hey, at that moment, when death looks very imminent, I mean, it's only going to add to your anxiety and your distress. And then he says here in verse 8, he says, but with an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of its sight. Now he's beginning to talk about Nineveh, because when it says its sight, it basically means the sight of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. He's going to make a complete end of it. How? By an overflowing flood. Well, I just read, you know, some of the statistics that they have uncovered as far as Nineveh was concerned. And one of them was that it had a moat of 150 feet wide that surrounded the city, and the wall stood like 100 feet high and 50 feet thick. But one of the things that allowed the enemies of Assyria or the Ninevites to be conquered was that there was an overwhelming flood. I think it was the Tigris River that overflowed, and it took out about a 2 and 2.5 mile stretch of their wall. And it just left them wide open to their enemies, and that's when their enemies just poured in and just made a complete destruction of the city. When it was like, hey, God created this natural disaster, and then he just allowed them to be overrun and completely annihilated as a nation, and then buried for centuries. And it says here, in verse 9, he says, whatever you devise against the Lord, he will make a complete end of it. Distress will not rise up twice, like tangled thorns and like those who are drunken with their drink. They are consumed as stubble, completely withered. In other words, you know, when God judged them, it was almost like he just took all of these thorns and these thistles and just threw them into the fire. I mean, there was just no escape, and they were just completely consumed. And he says in verse 11, it says, from you has gone forth the one who plotted evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. Thus says the Lord, though they are full of strength and likewise many, even so they will be cut off and pass away. Though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no longer. He talks about a specific person going forth from Nineveh. Look at that verse 11. For from you, Nineveh, has gone forth one who has plotted evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. And he says, thus saith the Lord, though they are at full strength, and likewise many, even so, they will be cut off and pass away. And I believe what he's talking about there, he's talking about that episode in 2 Kings chapter 19, where Sennacherib, who came against Jerusalem, he came against them, and he besieged the city, and he told Hezekiah, who was the king at that time, to surrender. And he said, don't put your trust in the Lord, because no nation has stood before me, and you certainly aren't going to stand before me either. And he just sit there and blaspheme God. But what happened was that Hezekiah took this letter that was written from Sennacherib. He took the letter of all the insulting things said about God's people and about Hezekiah and about God himself. And Hezekiah took it into the temple, and he sat before the Lord, and he laid out this letter of contempt towards God and his people. And he prayed and earnestly pled that God would deliver them, because they had no way of getting out of this. And it said that night, the angel of the Lord went through the camp of the Assyrian army, and he killed 185,000 of them. And Sennacherib had to turn right around and go back home when his army was just wiped out. And when he went back home to Nineveh, he was worshiping at the altar of his false god, and two of his sons killed him. So this is what I think this is what's referring to. So if you read 2 Kings chapter 19, especially verses 21 through 37, it talks about this evil person, this counselor, the one who has gone forth and showing God this kind of contempt. So, I mean, when God rises up, it doesn't matter how many thousands or millions of people there are in an army. He's just going to, when it's time for their judgment, there's no escape. And so it says here in verse 12, thus saith the Lord, though they are at full strength and likewise many, even so they will be cut off and pass away, though I have afflicted you. Now he's talking about Israel, God's people. He used the Assyrians to afflict his people when his people went astray, because the Assyrian army came down and they incarcerated away the northern tribes of Israel because of their wickedness and their idolatry and their forsaking God. And so God used the Assyrians as an instrument to chastise his people. But he says, I'm not going to use them any longer to do this. And he says in verse 13, so now I will break his yoke, bar from upon you, and I will tear off your shackles. Then the Lord issued a command concerning you, in other words, the king of Nineveh. Your name will no longer be perpetuated, and I will cut off idol and image from the house of your gods, and I will prepare your grave, for you are contemptible. It says he will prepare their grave. Well, over 2,000 years, nobody could find a trace of Nineveh. He buried him so deep. He prepared their grave. But, you know, I think it's kind of interesting. In Ezekiel chapter 32, there he lists almost a who's who in hell. And I don't have time to read the whole thing, but I think it's kind of significant, because I'll just read a little bit of it. He says, son of man, he's talking to Ezekiel here, says, wail for the multitude of Egypt and bring it down, her and her daughters of the powerful nations to the netherworld, to those who go down to the pit. In other words, he's talking about nations that go down to hell. He says, whom do you surpass in beauty? Go down and make your bed with the uncircumcised. They shall fall in the midst of those who are slain by the sword. She is given over to the sword, and they have drawn her and all her multitudes away. The strong among the mighty ones will speak of him and of his helpers from the midst of Sheol. From the midst of the Sheol stood for the grave, but it also stood for the netherworld. It stood basically for hell, depending on what context you're using it in. It says, they have gone down and lie still. The uncircumcised is slain by the sword. The uncircumcised is another name for the unsaved. It says here, Assyria is there and all her company. Her graves are round about her. All of them are slain, fallen by the sword, whose graves are set in the remotest parts of the pit, in the remotest part of hell. And in her company is round about her grave. All of them are slain, fallen by the sword, who spread terror in the land of the living. And it also says that Elam is there and all of her multitudes in her graves. So it not only talks about Elam, it talks about other nations, Meshech and Tubal. It talks about a prophecy of their multitudes going down to hell. It's almost like a who's who in hell. If you read the 32nd chapter of Ezekiel. And he says that Assyria is in the remotest part of hell as far as its nation is concerned. That doesn't mean that everybody who is Assyrian is in hell, but it certainly means that the nation, they have been utterly destroyed, and they have a special place for them, you know, in Sheol or the netherworld or another world or hell. That, to me, is pretty heavy. That's why it's saying the burden of Nineveh or the oracle is really the burden. I mean, this is a heavy message that, you know, no nation is going to escape. no nation. And when I was talking earlier about the cruelty of the Assyrians, how they would, when they would conquer a nation, of course they would rape and they would pillage and they would steal and they would plunder and they would do the most inhumane things to their prisoners or captured soldiers. Like I said, they would impale them on their heads on poles. They would skin them alive. They would torture them to, you know, in all kinds of inhumane, ignominious ways. I mean, you know, it just almost defies the imagination, the cruelty of these people. But I want to put things in perspective here. We, America, the United States, this nation has killed, has murdered, has annihilated over 40 million unborn children. Now, when God looked at Assyria to see her cruelty, what does he see in the United States? Now, the United States, we think that we're great. We think that we're the best thing, you know, to come along. In many respects, we are the most humane nation that history has ever known. We are a humanitarian nation. There isn't a nation on earth today that we haven't somehow helped in some manner. We are always the first on the scene to help people in natural disasters or all kinds of calamities. I mean, this is one of the reasons why God has been so long-suffering and patient with this nation. But we can't kid ourselves. We are not this good people that we think we are. We are showing more barbaric cruelty to our unborn children than Nineveh ever did upon, you know, grown adults. And I think that we have to put that in perspective because this is a warning to us. It's a warning to every nation. And then he says in verse 15, "Behold, on the mountains at the feet of him who bring good news, who announce peace, celebrate your feast, O Judah, pay your vows, for never again will the wicked one pass through you. He is cut off completely." And this is an interesting thing. This is a quote that's actually quoted in the book of Romans. It's a quote that you can find in the book of Isaiah. It talks about basically, "Behold, on the mountains the feet of him who bring good news." Or, you know, it's basically, Paul quoted this as far as the person who brings the news of salvation to other people. It's talking about them really being a blessing. Well, the good news here is when the news arrived down in Israel, hey, Assyria has been overthrown. The Babylonians and the Medes have invaded her, and they have destroyed her and destroyed her people. Well, that was reason for God's people to just stand up and cheer because the heavy yoke that had been around their neck for so long has now been removed. And that's going to be one of the great news for God's people when Christ finally comes back, is that, hey, all this wickedness is finally done and over and through. Okay. Anybody have any questions on that chapter 1? Okay, this chapter 2, it continues with the same theme when it says, "The one who scatters has come up against you. Man the fortresses, watch the road, strengthen your back, summon all your strength." It says here, "The one who scatters has come up against you." In other words, it's talking about, it's prophesying that the Babylonians and the Medes are going to come up against you. But look what it says here. "Man the fortress, watch the road, strengthen your back, summon all your strength, for the Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel. Even though the devastators have devastated them and destroyed their vine branches, the shields of his mighty men are colored red, the warriors are dressed in scarlet, the chariots are enveloped in flashing steel. When he is prepared to march, and the cypress spears are brandished, the chariots race madly in the streets, they rush wildly in the squares, their appearance is like torches, they dash to and fro like lightning flashes. He remembers his nobles, and they stumble in their march, they hurry to her wall, and the mantelet is set up, or the movable shelters are set up, and the gates of the rivers are open, and the palace is dissolved, and it is fixed. She is stripped, and she is carried away, and her handmaids are moaning like the sound of doves beating on their breasts." Again, the theme is the destruction of Nineveh and what's going to happen to them. It talks about here in that verse 2, "For the Lord..." Well, in verse 1, it talks about the one who scatters come against you, man your fortresses and watch the road and strengthen your back and summon all your strength. In other words, prepare yourself for a siege, but you can do anything you want to try to protect yourself, but it's not going to do you any good. I mean, it does tell us, I believe it's in Proverbs, that it says, "Unless the Lord guards a city, the watchmen do no good." And I know that this nation is seriously thinking of putting in a missile defense shield. But, you know, that's a good idea. It's being prudent as far as I'm concerned. But that's not going to save us. When it's time for our judgment, all the preparation in the world is not going to spare us. You know, what we really need to do is get down on our face and repent and seek God, and He will spare us, and that's the only way He will spare us. But anyway, it's talking about the destruction of Nineveh and Assyria, but then in verse 2 in this chapter 2, it says, "For the Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel, even though the devastators have devastated them and destroyed their vine branches." In other words, God used the Ninevites, He used the Assyrians to chastise His people, but the Ninevites are going into annihilation. But God's people are going to survive and thrive. You know, and then in verse 3 it says, "The shields of His mighty men are colored red, and the warriors are dressed in scarlet. The chariots are enveloped in flashing steel when He is prepared to march." In other words, the coming army, it was just going to be a bloodbath. Even their shields were just covered with red. In other words, blood. I mean, they were just slaying people left and right. And then it says here in that verse 4, it says, "The chariots race madly in the streets, they rush widely in the squares, their appearance is like torches, and they dash to and fro like lightning flashes." You know, when I used to read that, I used to wonder, well, you know, that's pretty picturesque. I'm wondering if it's describing some modern-day vehicles. Because if you read it, it says here, "The chariots race madly in the streets, they rush wildly in the squares, their appearance is like torches, they dash to and fro like lightning flashes." Well, it's not talking about some modern-day vehicles. It's just being very picturesque, and it's talking about the destruction of Nineveh by these invading armies. This is what happens when the sunlight was hitting on their spears, and it was hitting on the metal of the racing chariots. It looked like flashing torches. That's what this is talking about. In other words, it was just such a blitzkrieg. It was just there was just an overwhelming flood of the enemy coming upon these people. They just couldn't stand their ground. He says, "He remembers His nobles. They stumble in their march. They hurry to her wall, and the mantlet is set up." In other words, when he's talking about, it's talking about the invading armies. It's like they are rushing so fast, they're almost tripping over each other to get into the city, and they're putting up this Their shields, so the arrows or whatever else is coming down upon them, they can protect themselves. But it's basically saying that they are advancing so quickly that they're stumbling over each other. In verse 6, it says, "The gates of the river are opened, and the palace is dissolved, and it is fixed." And I think this has reference, too, to the fact that there was that overflowing flood before they got into the city, where, you know, a good portion of the wall was wiped out by a flood. And it says, in verse 7, she is stripped and she is carried away, and her handmaids are moaning like the sounds of doves beating on their breasts. In other words, you know, this everything's been turned on these people. These people have conquered nation after nation, and they have tortured people and raped and pillaged, and now it's happening to them. And in verse 8 it says, "Though Nineveh was like a pool of water throughout her days." In other words, she was a place of just refreshing, invigorating, and satisfying. Well, now it's completely turning. It says that now they are fleeing, stop. And it says she was like a pool of water. In other words, she was just calm, peaceful, nothing ever disturbed her. Well, now they're fleeing, and they're yelling, stop. In other words, their armies are fleeing in front of their enemies, and they're trying to say, stop your retreat, advance. You know, but everybody's running. It says, "No one turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold, for there's no limit to the treasure, wealth from every kind of desirable object." And verse 10 says, "She is emptied. Yes, she is desolate and waste. Hearts are melting. Knees are knocking. Also, anguish is in the whole body, and all of her faces are grown pale. Where is the den of lions and the feeding place of the lion, young lions? Where the lion, lioness, and lion cubs prowled with nothing to disturb them?" In other words, where are they now? They were the king of the mountains. They were king of the forest. They were king of the jungle. Nobody could stand against them. Well, where are they now? That's what he's just being poetic in what he's saying here. Nobody could stand against the lions, but now they're on a run. It says in verse 12, "The lion tore enough for his cubs, killed enough for his lioness, and filled his lairs with prey and his dens with torn flesh." Everywhere he went, he was conquering and assimilating everything that he could get his hands on. And in verse 13, "Behold, I'm against you, declares the Lord of hosts. I will burn up her chariots in smoke. A sword will devour your young lions, and I will cut off your prey from your land. And no longer will the voice of messengers be heard in you." So in other words, he's going to completely annihilate them as a nation, which he did. They had been so buried that for 2,000 years they couldn't find the site of Nineveh. And, you know, critics of the Bible said, well, that city never existed because they couldn't find it. Well, they found it. They unearthed it. You know, but God had buried them so deep that it says that no more messengers were heard of them. And in other words, you didn't hear a peep out of them. Okay, anybody have anything to add or share before we conclude this with the chapter 3? Okay, and then chapter 3, it says, woe to the bloody city, completely full of lies and pillage. Her prey never departs. The noise of the whip, the noise of the rattling of wheels, galloping horses and the bounding chariots, horsemen charging, swords flashing, spears gleaming, many slain, a mass of corpses, and countless dead bodies. They stumble over the dead bodies. It's being very descriptive here. Backing up, it says, woe to the bloody city. Woe to Nineveh. Completely full of lies and pillage. I mean, isn't that the way we are becoming today? The bloody city, completely full of lies and pillage. The bloody city. In other words, they had blood all over their hands. This is a bloody nation. 40 million unborn children have been destroyed. How many people murdered? How many people mass murdered? How many? Hardly a week goes by. You don't read about somebody going in and shooting up people in their workplace or, you know, some crowded place. This is a bloody city. Completely full of lies. Look what comes out of the mouth of so many of our politicians and our judges and lawyers. I mean, one deceit after another, and then pillage. That these companies are pillaging and plundering and stealing. You know, these guys all ought to go to jail forever, but because they are educated and wear ties and suits and $10,000 suits. I mean, they get away with this stuff. It says her prey never departs. The noise of the whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheel, galloping horses and bounding chariots. In other words, now the invading army is coming upon the city, and the horsemen charging, the swords flashing, spears gleaming, many slain, masses of corpse, and countless dead bodies. They will stumble over the dead. Well, what happened there in New York, in the Twin Towers? They're still trying to dig up the bodies. They're still digging them up. And that was just, that's a drop in the bucket of what's coming. But who has the foresight to see it? And then it says in verse 4, all because of the many harlotries and of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nation by her harlotries and families by her sorceries. In other words, Nineveh was just steeped in all kinds of occultic practices and witchcraft and sorcery, these type of things. Well, this nation is becoming more and more steeped in these things.
What does harlotry mean in sorcery?
Well, when I talk about harlotry, harlotry is basically prostitution. Is a harlot is a whore. So when it's talking about harlotries, it's talking about spiritual harlotries. It's talking about, instead of being faithful and true to God, they're being misled by all these false religions and these false cults and these occultic practices where they get into divination. I mean, the harlotries went on and on and on. And it also talks about sorceries. Well, sorceries was not only a form of witchcraft, but it also was the abuse of drugs, drug use. That's what the Greek word for that we get sorcery from is pharmakia, which we get the word pharmacy from. And it says here about how because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries and families by our sorceries. Well, this nation is one of the biggest exporters of pornography and with the entertainment industry that sells all of our movies and our videos throughout the world that really mislead people. They lead people away from God with so much of their harlotry, spiritual harlotry. Right. And in verse 5, it says, behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will lift up your skirt over your face, and I will show to the nations your nakedness, and to the kingdoms your disgrace. I will throw filth on you, and I will make you vile, and set you up as a spectacle. And it will come about that all those who see you will shrink from you and say, Nineveh is devastated. Who will grieve for her? Where will I seek comfort for you? And it's basically saying here that when he says, I will lift your skirt over your face, I will show the nations your nakedness. In other words, he's going to humiliate them before the world. Well, God has done a number of things to humiliate us before the world, but still we don't listen. We haven't turned back. And I think that we haven't seen nothing yet of what's coming as far as our humiliation is concerned, because we are not, as a people, as a nation, as a whole, turning back to God. Now, some people are saying, well, people are becoming more religious. Well, we got to understand something. Being religious and being committed to God are two totally different things. two totally different things. I mean, Isaiah said it best when he said, these people worship me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. We give God a lot of lip service, but how many of us are committed to him in obedience? And he says here in that verse, verse 8, says, are you better than Noamon, which is situated by the waters of the Nile? Another word for Noamon is Thebes. Thebes was a capital city, was a major, one of the major cities in Egypt. Well, she was overthrown in 663 B.C. And he's just asking, do you think you're better than her? She was more fortified than you. And, you know, when her judgment came, I judged her. That's what he said. So basically, you could say the same thing in the United States. It says, are you better than Noamon, which is situated by the waters of the Nile, with water surrounding her, whose rampart was the sea, whose walls consisted of the sea? Ethiopia was her might, and Egypt too, without limits. Put and Lubin were among her helpers. In other words, she had a strong ally. She was situated in a place where she was almost unconquerable. Geographically so located in a place where it just seemed like it was impossible to defeat her. And she had allies that guaranteed her success or her victory. But God says, hey, when it's time for judgment, hey, she was finished. She was through. It's over. Done. Same thing with you guys. Same thing in the United States. So I'm saying over and over and over again. I mean, we have been lulled asleep with a false sense of security that, hey, we are the greatest nation on earth. We are a superpower. Nobody can stand up against us. But look at what happened to us on September 11th. I mean, you know, these guys running around in caves, riding camels, did this to us. Well, that was just a warning. It was just a warning to us. In verse 10, it says, yet she became an exile. She went into captivity. Also, her small children were dashed to pieces at the head of every street. And they cast lots for her honorable men. And all her great men were bound with fetters. I mean, that's the kind of cruelty that went on there. Well, I'll tell you something. It talks about here what happened to Thebes, and it's making using this as a warning to Nineveh. But it says here that not only the children were dashed to pieces, it says here that her honorable men, they cost lots for honorable men. In other words, her politicians were sold into slavery. They're the ones that really are putting us in this mess. It's the cultural elite. Well, their day of judgment is coming too. But unfortunately, little children end up suffering because of the sins of their parents. This is why when people wonder, well, how could a tribulation period come if there's all the world's full of little children or infants or, you know, unborn children? I mean, you got to stop and think. What happened to Sodom and Gomorrah? You can't convince me that there wasn't any children in that city. You can't convince me that there were no children in the world during the Noahian flood. It was, again, the children had to suffer because of their parents. I don't believe that one child is in hell today, but most certainly they had to, you know, suffer the consequences of their parents' sinfulness. And on the contrary, we are told in Corinthians that the child is sanctified through the believing parent. You don't have to have two believing parents to have the children sanctified. But, you know, if you have small children, they haven't reached the age of accountability, and you are committed to Christ, well, those children are sanctified. They're made holy because of your belief, your faith, your trust in him. And then when they get to the age of accountability, then they make their own decision. But that's what it is. You know, God's not unjust. So in other words, you know, if parents have forsaken him, unfortunately, their children are going to suffer because of it. And in verse 11, it says, you too will become drunk. You will be hidden. You too will search for a refuge from the enemy. All of your fortifications are fig trees with ripe fruit. In other words, you're just easy pickings. When shaken, they fall into the eater's mouth. Behold, your people are women in your midst. The gates of your land are open wide to your enemies. Look at this. It says, behold, your people are women in your midst. In other words, this wouldn't go over with the Now gang today, right, with the feminist thinking. But it was a real insult to any soldier, anyone in those days to say you fight like a woman or your armies are like women. In other words, you know, let's face it, there's men and women have two totally different natures. And a woman is not cut out for warfare, period. Well, when push came to shove, the men became like women. And that's what it's saying here. And, you know, there was no political correctness in this statement. It says, Behold, your people are women in your midst. The gates of your land are open wide to your enemies. Isn't that what's happening to us? Our borders are sieves for all those who hate us. They just walk right in here, mm-hmm. you know, and give us the middle finger. That's all, you know, because of the stupidity of our leadership. That nobody wants to do the politically incorrect thing. Nobody wants to sound like a bigot. So everybody walks on eggs rather than saying, hey, there needs to be some profiling going on here. The gates of your land are open wide to your enemies. Fire consumes your gate bars. In other words, our defenses are a joke. They're a joke because of the stupidity that's running this nation. And why? Because the Bible says this, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We as a nation do not fear God. Therefore, we have no wisdom. And it certainly is showing in everything that we do. And it says here in verse 14, draw for yourself water for the seed, strengthen your fortifications, go into the clay and tread the mortar, take hold of the brick mold. There fire will consume you, the sword will cut you down, and it will consume you as a locust does. Look at it saying here, draw for yourself water for the seed, strengthen. In other words, prepare for the siege, prepare for the destruction. The city was under siege for almost 2 years, but then when the time came, it just happened like that. Okay. I mean, we're under siege right now. We are under siege. We have been for a number of years in a number of different ways, haven't we? The siege is almost like God's warning. When you are under siege, your enemy's at the gates, when you are being besieged, well, we could make all the preparations in the world, but when our time is up, bam, it's over. It's done. It's finished. It's through because it says, when it says, strengthen your fortifications, go into the clay and tread your mortar and take hold of its brick mold. In other words, make yourself bricks to build up your walls, build up your fortifications, build up your defenses. But what's it saying here? There, fire will consume you. The sword will cut you down. The very place that you're preparing, it's going to be come back on your face. We can make all the preparations in the world against our enemies, but it's right there that we're going to be hit and hit hardest. When God decides, okay, your time is up, you're finished, you're through. And verse 15, there fire will consume you, the sword will cut you down, it will consume you as the locust does. Multiply yourself like the creeping locust, multiply yourself like a swarming locust. You have increased your traders more than the stars of heaven. The creeping locust strips and flies away. The guardsmen are like the swarming locust. Your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers sitting in the stone walls on a cold day. The sun rises and they flee, and the place where they are is not known. In other words, what it's saying here is actually making a reference to the multitudes of Assyrian armies are like locusts. However, when it says here in verse 17, your guardsmen are like the swarming locusts, your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers settling in the stone walls on a cold day. Well, locusts are noted that on a cold day, they'll settle into cold walls, they'll settle on fences, they don't fly. But when the heat, when the sun rises and it becomes warm, you know, man, their blood starts circulating and then they take off and fly. Well, what it's saying here is that these multitudes of the Assyrians' armies, they're there waiting, but when the siege happens and when the invasion happens, it's like the heat turns on and they just fly away like locusts. In other words, they're going to turn tail and run. Run for their lives. That's the analogy that's being made here. And then in verse 18 it says, your shepherds are sleeping. Isn't that where we're at there? Our shepherds, our spiritual leaders, our political leaders, they're asleep at the switch, man. We are a train wreck waiting to happen. Your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Your nobles are lying down. Or, you know, our politicians are, you know, none of them have the guts of the spine to stand up and say, this is wrong and this is right. Or this is what's happening. Since your people are scattered on the mountaintops. In other words, there's nobody to lead them. Everybody's just doing their own thing. And there is no one to regather them. I mean, is there any leadership out there that can really take the bull by the horns and steer us in the right direction at this point in time? No. Call me a pessimist if you want, but I'm a realist. This is not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And finally, in verse 19, he says, there is no relief for your breakdown. Your wound is incurable. All who hear about you will clap their hands over you, for on whom has not your evil passed continually? And it says here, there's no relief for your breakdown. In other words, your wound is incurable. Our wound is incurable. When I say that our wound is incurable, I'm talking about our sin. We are not going to give up our abortions. We are not going to give up murdering you know, our own children. We are not going to give up experimenting on unborn children. We are not going to give up our pornography. We're not going to give up our drugs. We're not going to give up our homosexual practices, our fornications, and our adulteries. We're not going to repent of that. I just throw that out because I don't see us as turning that around, turning our whole moral climate around. That's why I'm saying our wound is incurable. In other words, I don't see a national revival coming. I don't see that we're going to be annihilated. God is very merciful, and I think he loves this country intensely. But because of he loves this country, he's going to take us behind a woodshed and beat us within an inch of our life. I guarantee it. And what we read here tonight, as far as Assyria is concerned, Nineveh is concerned, their destruction, to me, it is extremely instructive to us as a nation to tell us, hey, don't think for one minute that we can't be judged. Nineveh, the Assyrians thought, hey, we are invincible. And look what happened to them.